I have heard of beautiful cities far off in the land of the blessed, but in the only cities I've ever known, the weary get no rest.
From Colorado and today New York City, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com. And we have a book hour today, and it's a topic that... it's something I totally misjudge. When the publisher offered to send me the book, and it's about Puerto Rico, I thought, well, maybe for listeners it might have limited interest. And so I suggested to the publisher, maybe we could talk with the author and orient it towards something like the conditions in Puerto Rico today. That might be interesting. And I thought maybe listeners would perhaps gravitate to that just out of curiosity. But to the author's credit, the author is Nelson Dennis, he said that the book is historically important and America needs to hear what it has to say. Well, that piqued my interest, and the book came, I read it, and I was stunned. The author was absolutely right, and I was wrong on this issue. And I'm wrong, I think in part, because the media doesn't cover Puerto Rico very well. A couple weeks ago, the New York Times wrote an article about building financial troubles of Puerto Rico. But really, besides that, when was the last time any of us heard anything about Puerto Rico? Well, this book, and it's entitled The War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, blows the doors off our neglect. It reveals a history of U.S. and Puerto Rican relations, and honestly, we cannot be proud of it. It's as if this book was written by Howard Zinn, as if Mr. Zinn had placed a magnifying glass over Puerto Rico and wrote about 260 pages of the people's history of Puerto Rico. When you read this book, you will reassess what this country represents to Puerto Rico and ultimately the world. It is important. It needs to be discussed. And we're fortunate to have the author Nelson A. Dennis here with us. Nelson, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show.
Thank you, Tim, and I appreciate those words.
Well, deservedly. Again, I had a... you know, I'm just like any American. You think Puerto Rico and everything is a settled matter. It's 1,500 miles off our shores, and, you know, it's something to do with the United States, but really we don't know much about it. But really the United States took Puerto Rico from Spain in about 1898 or so, right? And the Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, they pay U.S. taxes. How would you describe it?
Well, you were right that the operative word is take. The Treaty of Paris that settled the Spanish-American War was basically a real estate closing, whereby Puerto Rico was one of several territories that were simply taken as literally and formally designated as possessions. And as such, the United States had complete discretion as to what to do with that possession. And in fact, and that's part of the substance of this book, is that that's exactly how Puerto Rico has been treated for 117 years.
Well, we look at this, and I think it wasn't, even though we took it over, or let's say we closed on it, you know, your apt description, in 1898, they were finally awarded citizenship and paying taxes, but they really never got full constitutional protections, did they?
Well, the way it worked is very quickly, the United States, it became an economic arm of the United States, and it was turned very quickly within 15 years into a one-crop cash cow economy, that of sugar cane. And within 30 years, 80% of the arable land in Puerto Rico was owned by U.S. banking syndicates, and that created the economic framework for everything that followed. And Puerto Ricans were not given citizenship because they weren't deemed members of the Union until it became more useful in 1917 under the Jones Act. It was known as the Jones Act. Puerto Ricans were granted citizenship 4 months before the United States entered into World War I. So it was essentially in time for military conscription into World War I. But that was a qualified citizenship because very shortly thereafter, when the Puerto Rican legislature tried to pass minimum wage legislation in 1922 under the Supreme Court case of Balzac v. Puerto Rico, it was found, the court found that the United States Constitution did not apply to Puerto Rico, that Puerto Ricans were not entitled to any privileges and immunities because it was not a state. It was an unincorporated territory. And so even though Puerto Ricans were officially, tacitly recognized as citizens for purposes of fighting in a war, they weren't. They didn't have the protection of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, you used a couple of terms in that, Nelson, that really jump out. And one is, you know, Puerto Rico was an economic arm, and then also the Puerto Ricans passed legislation to increase minimum wage. But that really defines the relationship. Throughout that initial history, Puerto Rico and of the United States and Puerto Rico, really it was the financial and corporate interests that predominated, right?
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. It also derives, it's not as if there was an evil empire that was just waiting. Although, if you look at what was said on the floor of the U.S. Senate, one might think that. U.S. senators, and it's in the congressional record, saying in 1899, when they were trying to figure out how to deal with their new territory, that, well, Puerto Ricans are savages and headhunters, and some of them are cannibals. Another senator called them savage and senile peoples. The New York Times said that they were more interested in wine, women, and dancing than anything else. And when, as you know, that one of the first and most important foundation works in being able to take over and do what you want with a foreign, with different people, is to dehumanize them or somehow marginalize them or make them less than you. And that was a generalized perception that then worked its way into the way that the United States dealt with them. In 1899, there was one of the biggest hurricanes in Puerto Rican history, Hurricane San Ciriaco. The United States sent no hurricane relief. Instead, the following year, they devalued the Puerto Rican currency, which was of essentially equal buying power internationally with the U.S. dollar, except they declared each Puerto Rican peso to be worth 60 American cents. So overnight, by legislative fiat, they consumed, they obliterated 40% of the savings and the wealth and the property holdings of every Puerto Rican on the island. Think of what would happen in the United States if there was a law that just scooped away 40% of everyone's bank account. It would be chaos. The society would not function. Think of the dislocation that happened when the two World Trade Center towers went. The ripple effect of that was enormous. Well, think of the ripple effect of a 40% currency devaluation taking away the wealth of everyone. Well, that's what happened in 1901. Then in 1902, the Hollander Act was passed, which inflicted a steeply graduated set of property taxes that no farmer had ever faced in Puerto Rico. So when you have that sort of that perfect storm of a hurricane, a currency devaluation, a new property tax, it's pretty obvious that your farmers are going to be very desperate. They're going to look for loans, some did, and the loans were being made by a properly titled the American Colonial Bank, but there was no usury law restriction. So within 5 to 10 years, you have farmers defaulting all over the island. It was, if you think about the 2007 mortgage crisis, just magnified by a factor of 10 or 20, and you will see how the effect of the United States-Puerto Rico relationship within the first 5 years. Then there's an interesting character. The first civilian governor of Puerto Rico was named Charles Herbert Allen. He was there all of 17 months because his first annual report to President McKinley was essentially a business plan for hardwiring the Puerto Rican agricultural economy. He left the governorship in 17 months, ran up to Wall Street, installed himself as a vice president of Morgan Guaranty Trust, and within just a few years, in less than 10 years, He was treasurer, then president, then chairman of the board of the American Sugar Refining Corporation, which owned 98% of the sugar refining capacity of the United States. And that company today is known as Domino Sugar. So Charles Herbert Allen is the almost a perfect figurehead for the approach that the United States took to Puerto Rico. It was just an island ripe for plunder, and that's the way that it was that it was approached, and that is what led to the violence that is the subject matter of my book.
Well, you wrote on page 96 something that really kind of encapsulate this. I mean, and I know we're dealing with 1931 in this case, but you wrote, and I'll just read one paragraph, one sentence. By 1931, Puerto Rico bore a strong American footprint. All of the island's sugar farms belonged to 41 syndicates. The banks owned 60% of the sugar plantations, 80% of the tobacco farms, and 100% of the coastal railroad shipping facilities and maritime vessels. AFL-CIO President Samuel Gompers reported, "I have never seen so many human beings showing so clearly the signs of malnutrition, nor such an accumulation of misery in one people." And this is really the effect of the corporate footprint, with your word, on Puerto Rico, and leads to the conditions of an attempted revolution.
And it's not Puerto Rico wasn't unique in that respect. Elsewhere in the book, if you look at in the epilogue, I discussed United Fruit Company and United Fruit, which is an American corporation. By 1928, United Fruit Company owned 200,000 acres of prime Colombian farmland. By 1930, it owned over 1 million acres of land in Guatemala, Honduras, Colombia, Panama, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Mexico, and Cuba. By 1940, United Fruit owned 50% of all the private land of the entire country in Honduras. By 1942, it owned 75% of all the private land in Guatemala, plus most of Guatemala's roads, power stations, phone lines, the only Pacific seaport, and every mile of railroad. What happened in Puerto Rico was just part of an ongoing fabric. Unfortunately, it wasn't unusual. By 1950 in Puerto Rico, the banks owned, as we discussed, well over half of the, close to over three quarters of the arable land in Puerto Rico, plus the insular postal system, the entire coastal railroad, and San Juan's international airport. And the Pentagon controlled another 13% of the acreage of the island. So it was a pretty dominant situation. And it was not what people understand as a sort of a bilateral commonwealth, even though that's the commonly held. It's sort of a colonial tapestry, unfortunately. And to show you how aggressive they were about preserving that, the man known as Pedro Albizu Campos, the first Puerto Rican to graduate from Harvard, Law School, and he's really the driving personality in this book. He became the president of the Nationalist Party in Puerto Rico, and he advocated and editorialized, organized in many towns. He was in full throat early from the beginning on behalf of the independence of movement of Puerto Rico. Well, the United States didn't really care. There was this man down in Puerto Rico. It's no big deal until 1934, when he led an island-wide agricultural strike. That spoke to the heart of America, who, after all, the business of America is business, particularly in Puerto Rico. When he led that strike, which ended up doubling the sugarcane workers' wages from 75 cents a day to $1.50 a day, which really wasn't much by American standards, but was the difference between starvation and not in Puerto Rico. When he did that in 1934 is precisely when the United States then militarized the entire police force. They sent down a new governor named General Blanton Winship, and a new police chief named E. Francis Riggs, whose father, by the way, was the president of the Riggs National Bank, which had another series of investments throughout South and Central America. Well, that was in 1935, as an immediate response to the agricultural strike. And immediately thereafter, the violence began. There was four people were assassinated in broad daylight in Rio Piedras. It was known as the Rio Piedras Massacre. by the police. And he, Police Chief Riggs held a press conference immediately after to explain what was going on. And he told the island press, intending that they would disseminate this throughout the island. At the press conference, Police Chief Riggs says that if Albizu Campos and the Nationalists continued to agitate the sugarcane workers, there would be war to the death against all Puerto Ricans.
Well,
and that's the title of my book.
Well, Nelson, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have to break for a quick commercial. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about Luis Munoz Marin and Pedro Albizu Campos, because it just shows what the people want versus what the U.S. military and government wanted in Puerto Rico. We're talking with Nelson A. Dennis, who is the author of the new book, War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, and you're listening to him here on The Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back.
Mansions, far up in the azure sky, but the only mansions I've ever known were not for you.
Preserve a nation one community at a time, with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join us today, coffeepartyusa.com.
I have heard a beautiful story and of times that are going to be, but the only times that I've ever known are bad for you.
We, the people of the United States of America, reject the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United ruling and other related cases, and move to amend our Constitution to firmly establish that money is not speech, and that human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. Go to movetoamend.org. Add your voice to the 350,000 people who say, enough. This is a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
I've heard of beautiful countries far off in the land of the dead.
Welcome back to the Tim Danny Show here at DannyHe.com, and it's our privilege to be talking with the author, Nelson A. Dennis, and he wrote just a totally surprising, totally captivating, totally frightening book about a subject for which I know very little until reading this book, and the book is entitled War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony. It's put out by Nations Books, and I believe it just came out, or is it about to come out, Nelson?
Just came out last week.
Excellent, and just a fabulous book. And I should mention, too, bless your heart, Nelson, that you mentioned Smedley Butler twice in the book. And in the first one, you just showed what the profitability of war was, I believe, and, you know, how it was just good business to exploit places like Puerto Rico. But there's two characters that I think kind of are very important in this, the history of Puerto Rico and the United States, and that would be Luis Munoz Marin and Pedro Albizu Campos. Now, you've mentioned a little bit about Albizu Campos, but it's important because one represents the people and one represents the U.S. government and military. Can you talk about those just a little bit?
Well, they recognize each other, and in fact, they at one point there was a mutual respect between Luis Munoz Marin and Pedro Albizu Campos. As I said earlier, Albizu Campos was the first Puerto Rican graduate from Harvard Law School, and he went back to the island and became the president of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, which was looking to sever its ties with the United States. It was an independence party. Luis Munoz Marin was the son of a very well-known man on the island named Luis Munoz Rivera. And Luis Munoz Rivera was one of the principal prior advocates for the independence of Puerto Rico. He had even gone to Spain to advocate for the independence of Puerto Rico from Spain prior to the U.S. occupation in 1898. And it was actually Luis Muñoz Rivera, his father, who negotiated the terms of the Carta de Autonomía, the Charter of Autonomy that Puerto Rico had secured from Spain just literally a few months prior to the Spanish-American War. It created an indigenous Puerto Rican legislature and control of its own borders, its import and export restrictions, its tariff structure. It was the closest thing to national sovereignty that Puerto Rico ever had, either before or since. Unfortunately, it ended up becoming a provisional government because it only lasted about 4 months, because the United States came in as a quote-unquote liberating entity. But what in fact they did was impose their own regime in Puerto Rico, and they obliterated the Charter of Autonomy, and they put into place an even more restrictive colonial arrangement. And so Luis Muñoz Marín's father had advocated and had even secured a substantial measure of autonomy for Puerto Rico, and he was appropriately revered as a national hero for that. His son was following in that tradition. He didn't really want to get involved in politics. He spent the large part of his youth in Greenwich Village. He went back and forth between the United States and Puerto Rico and led what he was a self-declared bohemian life in Greenwich Village, where he developed a certain set of bohemian habits, which later on, really ironically and perversely, came to have a defining impact on Puerto Rican politics. I'll get to that. He finally comes to the island of Puerto Rico, essentially broke, because he sort of came to the end of his tether of his bohemian ways, and in 1932, and realized that he could avail himself of his father's great political reputation to get involved in politics, and he did, and he got elected, and he became a member of the Senate in 1932. Originally, he was leaning, and because he had to, he was the apple wasn't going to fall far from the tree. He was an independentista. He was in the tradition of his father. That's how he got elected. So he couldn't deviate very far from that. But an odd thing happened. After the agricultural strike of 1934, the police chief, E. Francis Riggs, had a meeting with, he called Albizu Campos to a luncheon at El Escambrón, a very fancy casino restaurant in Puerto Rico. And at El Escambrón, under completely documented circumstances, with multiple witnesses, and it was even then reported in El Imparcial newspaper the next day, Chief Riggs offered Albizu Campos $150,000, and the majority leadership of the Senate if he would back off of the agricultural strike and go easy on his nationalist demands, basically sell out his principles. It was pretty much a naked bribe. Albizu Campos very respectfully but firmly rejected it and left the luncheon. That was it. That same offer was repeated to Luis Muñoz Marín, who took it. He then became, under the auspices of, he was already a senator as of 1932. This meeting at El Escambrón happened in 1935. And so the Chief Riggs knew that he needed to have sort of a point person in Puerto Rico. If it wasn't going to be Pedro Albizu Campos, the head of the Nationalists, he went with Plan B, with Luis Muñoz Marín. So that's when the relationship with the United States started. It then deepened when the violence started to break out. It became especially more important to have a point person after the Ponce Massacre of 1937, where the police chief's army, because at this point the police had been militarized, slaughtered 17 Puerto Ricans in broad daylight on Palm Sunday in a peaceful march down the streets of Ponce, and it became known as the Ponce Massacre. But it became truly solidified, and that was in 37. But 6 years later, in 43, the relationship became sealed because the one element of the empire of the United States dealing with Puerto Rico was to maintain secret police dossiers known as carpetas. If you think that that the internet and the revelations of Ed Snowden are something now, you really got to take a gander at what happened in Puerto Rico with over 100,000 carpetas opened on over 100,000 Puerto Ricans. One of those even was opened up by J. Edgar Hoover on Luis Muñoz Marín himself. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover was going crazy down in Puerto Rico. He sent hundreds of FBI agents. If you drank coffee, you have to be careful when you tilted the cup because there may be J. Edgar right there. Well, the file on Luis Muñoz Marín had information from multiple informants that he had a lifelong narcotics addiction. Specifically, he smoked opium. And this was something that he never gave up. He was addicted and he kept doing it. And this was in April of 1943 that this report was made and filed and given to J. Edgar Hoover. And here's the amazing thing. I mean, history sometimes is just fact being stranger than fiction. And this is not fringe journalism. I mean, this is the FBI report. We put it verbatim in the, you know, we amplified the page and it's in, we copied it. The image is in the book. Right after that FBI report, Luis Muñoz Marín made a complete about face on his political principles and his party platform. His party was a Partido Popular, and their emblem on their flag was Pan, Tierra, Libertad, bread, land, liberty. The liberty specifically referred to liberty from the United States. Well, he completely changed after this FBI report. Within a matter of weeks, he went up to Washington to lobby against the independence of Puerto Rico because Senator Miller Tidings had put forward a Tidings bill. He was the chairman of the Insular Affairs Committee in the Senate, which eventually created the independence of the Philippines, the Tidings bill. Well, there was a similar Tidings bill for Puerto Rico, and on three separate occasions, in 43, 46, and 48, Luis Muñoz Marín went up on a tramp steamer to Washington to specifically lobby against the Tidings bill. And the first trip coincided almost exactly with that FBI report on his personal habits. So it's really sort of a nasty turn of events. He then himself, Luis Muñoz Marín, in 48, passed Public Law 53, which was known as La Ley de la Mordaza, the Law of the Muzzle. That law, Law 53, made it illegal to utter a word, sing a song, whistle a tune, make any expression that had to do with the independence of Puerto Rico. It was basically created a thought police. It was so severe that if you owned a Puerto Rican flag the size of a postage stamp and kept it in a shoebox in your closet, forget waving it in the street, just owning it in your own home, the police could knock on your door and break down your door, arrest you, and you could be imprisoned. It was a felony. You could be imprisoned for 10 years under Law 53. This was passed by Luis Muñoz Marín. The timing of that law was also significant. The law was passed exactly four months after Pedro Albizu Campos was released. He had been in prison for 10 years at that point. So Albizu Campos gets out of prison, and Luis Muñoz Marín passes Law 53, essentially abrogating the First Amendment rights of the entire island in order to shut up one man. So you get a real sense of this two men battling for the soul of Puerto Rico. And it sounds dramatic. It sounds like a Hollywood screenplay, but it's actually a historical fact. And it's an unfortunate one because it shows how the United States sort of pitted brother against brother in Puerto Rico. And the Carpetas program is probably the best example of that, when you had 100,000 files with police informants basically spying and reporting on each other in Puerto Rico.
Well, it was just a frightening situation throughout. And then in this corporate police state, which really enabled by the FBI and their surveillance on everybody. I think you mentioned that these 100,000 people that had the carpeta, the file, the people tried to make light of it, but there was over 1.5 million pages of information on Puerto Rican citizens, all to make sure that the Nationalist Party did not arise to power and push for independence. We're running a little bit long. Can you stay over for another segment?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll be glad to.
Okay, we have to break for a quick commercial again. We'll come back with Nelson A. Dennis, who is the author of the book War Against All of Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, and we'll be right back.
But in the only countries I've ever known, the poor and hungry lack bread.
The network grows. Voices speaking news corporate media won't broadcast. Danahy.com, EgbertoWillies.com, and now we add ITakeLibertyWithMyCoffee.com with Bobby Rodrigo. Informed, progressive, truthful voices discussing issues above the soundbites of politicians and press releases. Real news with consequences for America, for democracy, for justice, for you. Welcome to Bobby Rodrigo and ITakeLibertyWithMyCoffee.com. Listen now. Why do you send your food money to faraway factory farms and industrial ranchers distributing through megastores headquartered in other cities, other states? It doesn't make sense. You can keep your dollars local. Help your local farmer, your local rancher, your local retailer, your neighbors. And it comes back. Your commitment to the local food shift means more money stays in the community and is reinvested here. Reinvested in you. It's easy and it's smart. Go to localfoodshift.com. Learn how to buy local and watch it grow here. Localfoodshift.com. The Tim Danahy Show at Danahy.com is where you go when you want to listen to investigative and thoughtful discussion. When you want to understand the issues without the agendas, we discuss government, but not politics, world affairs, economics, social issues, justice, many topics. And every Friday, we have fun and talk about global authors and their new books. And the subjects range beyond simple description. Come listen and download at Danahy.com. Be one of the listeners who value honest discussion you won't hear anywhere else. Danahy.com.
I have heard of beautiful garments to be worn by the fighters of sin, but the only garments I've ever known in winter were terribly thin.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and I'm so appreciative that Nelson A. Dennis, the author of War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony, has agreed to stay on for another segment. It's a rare opportunity that I even ask an author to do that, but this book is so captivating, and there's more, because there's really what happened in Puerto Rico with the corporate police state, with the FBI, surveillance state set up, and the will of the people versus the will of the government. There's just lessons, many, many lessons, not only about Puerto Rico, but really our national values. But the people rose up as best they could, Nelson. And, you know, the Luis Munoz Marin was a drug addict and was only interested in preserving his power and privileges. Pedro Albizu Campos lived side by side with the FBI as they monitored everything he did and accompanied him everywhere. But there were tales of courage. There was the barbershop with Vidal Santiago Diaz, and his he really is one of the most courageous Americans or Puerto Ricans or that I've I've encountered. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Well, Vidal Santiago Diaz was, there's a lot to him. He's one of these quiet figures in history that you have to sort of dig under the surface a little bit. He was very pro-nationalistic after he had personally witnessed the Ponce massacre in 1937. And he owned a barbershop in the Santurce, the Barrio Obrero, the poor section of Santurce, which was happened to be less than a mile away from Camp Las Casas, which for a while was the, for about two decades, was the largest military installation in Puerto Rico until they created Roosevelt Roads. That's significant because once he became a nationalist, he found a contact at Camp Las Casas that was able to sell him guns. They would pilfer guns from the U.S. military and sell them to Vidal, and he would store them. He had a weapons cache right next door to the Salon Barico barbershop. It was pretty ingenious the way that he became one of the principal weapons providers for the Nationalist Party. He was also Albizu Campos's personal barber. So he was the one that got to put his blade to the neck of Albizu Campos on a regular basis. And for all of those reasons, he was followed assiduously by the FBI for a long time. And at one point, he was lifted up by the FBI and taken to a safe house in Aguadilla, where he was tortured for information. So this is all background to what happened during the revolution of 1950. When that broke out, Vidal was in his barbershop, but he had already been surrounded by FBI agents for years. So they tightened the noose on the barbershop, and one insular policeman made the mistake of going in there with his gun drawn. And Vidal, who had just been tortured in another facility, really wasn't in the mood for seeing a cop with a gun drawn in his barbershop. So he shot at the cop. I think he shot his hat off. Cop goes running out. Well, that was it. Immediately, an APB went out, and more police and National Guardsmen arrive at the scene, 40 of them. And we have a three-hour gun battle that is witnessed by the. It was the first time that the island-wide radio press converged on one event, and it was like the War of the Worlds broadcast by Orson Welles, where everyone was experiencing this live event for the first time in Puerto Rico. There was an island-wide audience. It was like reality radio, and it went on for 3 hours. And the National Guardsmen thought that there had to be 20 or 30 nationalists inside that barbershop because. He put up such a savage fence out of every door and window because, you see, he had all this stored up ammunition. He figured this was his only way. He said, well, the revolution begins and ends in this barbershop at this point. So he held off these guys for 3 hours with the island-wide radio press. And a childhood friend, El Bibi Marrero, was one of the radio broadcasters. And he was having discussions with Vidal, yelling back and forth through the door, even as the thing was going on. Vidal didn't let on. It did not behoove him to let people know that he was alone in there. So he just led everybody to believe that there were, whatever, three, four dozen nationalists in there. He had three fingers blown off his left hand. Another shot came very close to his femoral artery. He kept going. This was the raging bull of Puerto Rico. Finally, the only way that they were able to put down this barber was with two 50-caliber Browning machine guns. They just fired nonstop into the barbershop until the staircase crashed on his head and rendered him unconscious. I mean, it's just amazing. Well, so then the National Guard carefully tiptoe in because they think there's 30 or 40 nationalists in there. So they tiptoe in, and they see this one guy. This one man buried under a pile of rubble. Well, just to make sure that he's dead, a guardsman goes up to him and shoots another bullet into his head. They shoot him in the head. Then they drag him out. Now, the National Guard is a little embarrassed at this point. Everyone's scratching their head. They say, you guys were shooting at this barber for 3 hours? But here's where the pot suddenly thickens. The corpse that they drag out suddenly opens its eyes. The barber's still alive. And that, at that moment, is when Vidal Santiago became completely endeared to the Puerto Rican public. No matter what politics you had, you know, Puerto Ricans really appreciate an underdog, having been underdogs, you know, their whole history. So at this point, Vidal Santiago Diaz became the barber who defied an empire with a bullet in his brain and lived to tell the story. And he's a great hero.
Well, and the 20 or 30 pages that you had about this story, I mean, the government used bazookas and grenade launch. I mean, they had a whole arsenal to try and take out this little barbershop with one man in it. And it's just an incredibly written and riveting, actually. But and there's one other piece of trivia that came through in your book, too, that as the people of Puerto Rico were fighting, and they're U.S. citizens, and they were fighting for their own independence, it's the only instance where the U.S. government has used jet fighters from the U.S. military to bomb U.S. citizens, right?
Yeah, and the irony is that Harry Truman afterwards called the whole thing an incident between Puerto Ricans, because he wanted to minimize the thing before the UN Decolonization Committee, because it certainly wouldn't suit the United States to be the quote-unquote leader of the free world and then be found to be holding the only colony in modern-day existence. So even as he dismisses that to here up stateside so that, you know, to sort of misdirect people, down in the island, they within the space of 1 week, they arrested 3,000, they deployed 5,000 National Guard troops, arrested 3,000 Puerto Ricans, and bombed the two towns, the towns of Jayuya and Utuado, with P-47 Thunderbolt fighter planes, which then, after bombing the two towns, then strafed the surrounding mountainsides and sugarcane fields with 50-millimeter automatic machine guns that were mounted on the planes. So all of this of reaction from the United States to suppress what Harry Truman called was an incident between Puerto Ricans, it really doesn't square up. And yes, it was the only time in American history that the United States government bombarded its own citizens. There were Tulsa race riots. There was a sort of a biplane that was a private plane. Someone commandeered it, and they threw some Molotov cocktails. That was about 30 years earlier, and I'm aware of that, but that wasn't the U.S. government. This is the U.S. government bombing two towns, and the New York Times itself, about 2 days later, on November 3rd, reported that Jayuya looked as if an earthquake had hit it.
And they also kind of reported it as being a fire set by the nationalists.
I'm glad you caught that nuance, Tim, because that's exactly. See, Puerto Rico at that time, whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but whatever happened in Puerto Rico never happened at all. Even as late as 1950, Puerto Rico was still a nation. I call it a nation. Separated from the United States by 3,000 miles of ocean from New York and Washington to Puerto Rico, 3,000 miles in ocean. So it's separated by an ocean, a language, a culture, 400 years of Ibero-American history, by technology. There was no television in Puerto Rico in 1950. There was certainly no internet. The only way news got off the island, it went through the hands of, say, half a dozen to maybe 10 reporters, tops of AP and UPI wire news reporters. That was it. So anything to get off the island took some sort of very dramatic, galvanic gesture that would galvanize world attention. And that's what Pedro Albizu Campos was trying to do in 1950 with this revolution. It was modeled after the Easter Rising of 1916 in Ireland. It wasn't an attempt. There was no way to defeat the American Empire. They had just obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So Puerto Rico wasn't going to defeat the United States, but it needed to capture world attention so that the UN Committee on Decolonization could could finally see that there was a problem in Puerto Rico, and then the world could get involved and intervene in that situation. And that was the attempt of the revolution.
Well, Nelson, we have about five more minutes left in the show. What's the condition of Puerto Rico today? I mean, after 60 years of Carpetas, the surveillance, corporate surveillance state and enforced by the military and the FBI, what's its condition today, and how can Puerto Rico heal?
It's a complicated situation, and there can't be an easy solution. If I could give a prescription and have it followed, I know that I might be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize or something. However, there are some specific recommendations, some things that are clear. Given the underpinnings of essentially colonialism in the United States from the beginning, given the way that Puerto Rico can be said to, they had their legs taken away from them 117 years ago, and they've been replaced by a series of crutches that simply haven't worked. They've had Operation Bootstrap and IRS 936, which is an exemption for corporate taxes. 20-year corporate tax exemption, that all sorts of giveaways to corporations, that a red carpet has run from San Juan to Wall Street all this time. All the profits have been continually repatriated back to United States banks and corporations. So it's never created a manufacturing or an economic infrastructure in Puerto Rico. So it's always a boom-bust scenario, where the paternalistic entity, the United States, comes in and gives another set of crutches to Puerto Rico, but then when economic conditions change, they leave. They were thinking of creating oil refineries in Puerto Rico, but after the OPEC strike in the 70s, that changed. They had high labor-intensive factories, Playtex and Schick, and plastics companies in Puerto Rico. But when those corporations could find cheaper labor in Malaysia and other parts of the third world, they left. Puerto Rico now has a $73 billion public debt. But that debt wouldn't have existed if Puerto Rico had control over its own import and export and its own borders. I'll give you one example. The cabotage laws, the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, known as the Jones-Shafroth Act, created a maritime situation where Puerto Rico cannot have any products come into the island that aren't on U.S. ships. There has to be a U.S. flagship, has to have been built in the U.S., has to be owned and operated by U.S. personnel. Now, what that means is if you have cars from Japan, finished goods from Europe, medicine from Canada, food from South America, everything that comes to that island, It has a point of origin. It comes from foreign ships. All of those products have to be unloaded off of all of those ships and then reloaded onto a U.S. ship, and it's usually done in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, this is the equivalent of digging a ditch and filling it again, and it's an amazing – it's like an equivalent of a mafia shakedown. It's like a protection racket where you can't do anything unless you come through us. Well, the adjusted net revenue cost of that to the Puerto Rican government, forget the Puerto Rican consumer, which has absorbed the add-on cost of that because the price of products is just passed on to the consumer. The net revenue cost to the Puerto Rican government has been roughly $1 billion a year since 1920. That's 95 years. That's $95 billion. That far exceeds the current $73 billion public debt of Puerto Rico. So in one fell swoop, if we eliminated the cabotage law, which serves no purpose other than to provide employment for the U.S. maritime industry and to provide additional revenue to the U.S. government and provide jobs in Jacksonville, Florida, if we eliminated that, there is a dysfunctional imbalance in the Puerto Rican economy right now of about $1 billion a year. But if you add up that $1 billion a year That's $95 billion that would account for the entire public debt of Puerto Rico. So that just gives you an example, Tim, of how the relationship, how it's defined, because the United States has plenary jurisdiction over all the legislation from Puerto Rico. They can veto any law, including that minimum wage law that I told you about. So the United States, it can ignore a plebiscite. If there was a plebiscite in 2012, the results of which were ignored by the United States. So the relationship with it has to be addressed, because it is that relationship that is inuring to the detriment of Puerto Rico. We wouldn't need food stamps. We wouldn't have to have a food stamp economy or all sorts of entitlement benefit programs if Puerto Rico were allowed to exist and have its own entrepreneurial and its own manufacturing base, which it currently doesn't have. And we need to start with those cabotage laws. They're killing Puerto Rico.
Well, Nelson, this is an extraordinary story. The book is War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony by Nelson A. Dennis. It's coming into the bookstores. Either it's there now or coming almost immediately. It's coming. It just came out this week. This is a book, I would tell you, that I would look at my local independent bookstore. I would pick it up. I would thumb through it and say, Puerto Rico, I don't know much about it, and it may not capture my interest initially, and I would have lost something. I read this book. This is remarkable, and it's more than Puerto Rico. It's the United States, and it's a context for all our foreign relations. There are tales of courage. There's tales of revolution. There's government surveillance, corporate influence on government. It's all in this book, and it's all true. It's all thoroughly researched with dozens and dozens of pages of notes and sources. A great book, War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony. And Nelson Dennis, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Tim Danahy Show.
Thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate it.
You're a good man. Thank you.
But the only banquet I've ever had was a piece of moldy pie.
The Tim Danahy Show would like to thank Aaron Taylor of SRC Labs for IT strategy, social media support, and event management. Presonus, a leading designer and manufacturer of audio recording software, hardware, and related accessories available at Guitar Center. For Edward Danahy for post-production assistance, and Theodore the studio dog for his quiet companionship.
And I'm tired of hearing of these beautiful things in the land beyond the grave. And the only thing I know for sure is that here I am. And I'm tired of hearing of these beautiful things in the land beyond the grave. And the only thing I know for sure is here I am a slave.